listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
President Assad has lost the legitimacy to lead, and it is clear that Syria would be better off without him.
That was then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking in August of 2011.
Yesterday, the United States imposed new sanctions, and Ambassador Ford delivered a clear message to the Syrian government. Immediately stop the violence, withdraw your security forces, respond to the legitimate aspirations of the Syrian people for a democratic transition in concrete and meaningful ways.
Over the past 7 years, in fact, things have turned out quite differently. For more on all of that, we spoke with Mark Sloboda. He's a senior lecturer at Moscow State University on international affairs, and we caught up with him via Skype from Moscow Friday.
So things are happening fast in Syria now. It was just a couple months ago that we saw the liberation of the final suburbs around Damascus, when we saw Eastern Ghouta recovered with the last attempted claims by the self-proclaimed Army of Islam of a chemical weapon attack there, that at least the initial claims, certainly the involvement of any type of nerve agent or sarin gas, which was claimed by the rebels being the Army of Islam, and picked up by the White Helmets and by the U.S. government, claims that it was sarin nerve agent in Douma, have been disproven by the Organization of Prohibition of Chemical Weapons interim report. They actually, for the first time, actually had people on the ground because the Syrian government regained control of that territory, so they could actually get people in on the ground. They did samples all over the place. They talked to more people than just those presented by Al-Qaeda and friends to them. And they have already determined that there was no organophosphates, which means no nerve agents. Sarin was definitely not used. And, you know, that exposes the first big chemical weapon hoax. There's still a question of whether chlorine weapons were used, but chlorine isn't really an offensive type of weapon in any sort more than an irritant. When chlorine is weaponized as a chemical weapon, it is only very rarely results in any deaths. It's mainly used as an irritant to drive people out, and there is some evidence that chlorine compounds were found in the area, but none of those point directly towards use as a chemical weapon, because chlorine is found in just about everything, in industrial society.
It's in my kitchen.
Yeah, I mean, if a bomb hits an area with plastics, that's going to release chemical weapons,
right.
Chlorine compounds into right. the area. So anyway, at least the nerve agent side of this, which would have been a serious chemical weapon, has been disproven. And, you know, that latest chemical weapon false flag has been disproven to that extent anyway. And then there was a big push south on Dara, which is southwest Syria. It abuts on Jordan and Israel, including, of course, the Israeli-occupied Syrian Golan Heights. And there was a grab bag of the usual rebels down there, meaning an area controlled by ISIS, an area controlled by Al-Qaeda, and an area controlled by a grab bag of other jihadists and Islamists formerly supported by the U.S. that got along just fine with both Al-Qaeda and ISIS down there. This situation was complicated because it's right up on what they call the Israeli border. It's actually the Syrian Golan Heights border, so the occupied Golan Heights. Israel was screaming and throwing a fit at the idea. First of all, they didn't want the area retaken. Second of all, they certainly didn't want it retaken by any Iranian advisors, Shia militias, right. Backed by Iran or Hezbollah.
Right.
And evidently, there isn't any public word from Russia about any such deals being struck, but it is obvious that something was done, because that is indeed what happened. The entire area has now been liberated. It happened very quickly. There was some initial resistance that was met with overwhelming force, and then after that, it was just a grab bag of rebels surrendering, and many of them of the more moderate sort actually laying down their weapons, some of them even joining the Syrian army and helping in the fight against ISIS down there, the rest of them surrendering and either accepting amnesty or taking the green buses up to Idlib. And that ends that. The last ISIS enclave down there was defeated. Israel was seemingly unhappy about the way it happened and launched some attacks. And what it said was Iranian forces in central Syria, a few airstrikes. But this all seems to have been finished. Russian peacekeepers are patrolling the border, such as it is, between Syria and the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. And now even UN peacekeepers, which were driven out by the U.S. and Saudi-backed moderate rebels years ago, even now UN peacekeepers are back on the Golan Heights border with Syria there. So the war in the south is over. The south has been liberated. Important economic highways to Jordan have been reopened, refugees have already started to return. There was a lot of noise in the Western press about some 250,000 refugees, displaced people fleeing the fighting, all of that turned out to be false.
Right.
There were some people that fled the immediate area of conflicts, but they have already mostly returned to their homes. So once again, we had a lot of fake news, the wringing of hands about human rights and so on, you know, in defense of the occupation by Al-Qaeda and ISIS and the other 31 flavors of jihad. And none of it really turned out to be true once again. There is no words of any type of high civilian casualties, collateral damages in the area. And the war in the South is over.
And then what we've seen in each case that the territory got reclaimed this way also is after a very short period of time, in other words, once the hostilities are done and it's clear that there's no more hostilities, the people that have been driven out of there by ISIS for, you know, a year, 2, 3 years or whatever, they come flocking back in massive numbers, showing that this is what they want.
The people largely return. Christian churches are able to reopen.
Right.
Reconstruction actually begins. Conflict ends. There is no type of insurgency against the government in the area. The locals largely welcome the return of law and order and the Syrian government to the area. And it has to be said, Daraa itself was once, you know, said that is where the quote revolution, as it's called, you know, by the rebels began. So this is, it's the first time that the Syrian government has regained control of this area, since the beginning of the war. And it's right. fairly significant. And how quickly it happened and how thoroughly has totally demoralized, what resistance remains in the country.
Yeah, this war started, we're talking February, March of 2011. Okay, we were hearing from Obama and Clinton and all of the experts that both the Al-Qaeda and the whole group of jihadists and then ultimately ISIS was going to be a fight that was going to take a generation maybe or something. And then the Russians got involved in late September of 2015. It's not even 3 years yet. And once Obama departed the scene, especially at the end of 2016, just all of a sudden, boom, ISIS is, people are thinking of that goddess again instead of, this group that was going to be taking over the world. And Syria has almost regained all of its territory. Amazing.
Well,
that's where
we're coming to.
Well,
now.
We've got the stuff going on.
All
right,
of its territory. There,
I said almost.
There is still a third of the country that is not in Syrian government hands, slightly over a third of the country.
Okay.
And there are two big areas that remain. The one is the area to the east and the northeast across the Euphrates. Controlled by the U.S. and its proxy forces, the Syrian Democratic Forces, which the majority of which are Kurdish, YPG.
Right.
As we speak, the leaders of the PKK, the political wing of the Kurds in Syria, are negotiating very seriously with the Syrian government. Four terms that will see Syrian government authority extend over the areas controlled by the Kurds and in return for some degree of autonomy, perhaps the retention of Kurdish militias in some form. That's all being worked out. But evidently the Kurds very wisely, finally, have come to recognize that the U.S. is not a reliable partner and are seeking their own peaceful settlement with the Syrian government, which, to be fair, they have not really fought in any serious way. They've spent the entire 7 years fighting Islamists, fighting ISIS, fighting Al-Qaeda, fighting Pentagon-backed Free Syrian, CIA-backed Free Syrian Army. But they have never in any, other than a few localized skirmishes by young hotheads that were quickly papered over. There hasn't been, they have not seriously had any conflict with Syrian government forces. In fact, Syrian government and Russia have continually provided them with supplies, arms, and even close air support. They are proving reasonable, particularly when they realize that the U.S. will, like it has with the Kurds every other place, thrown them under the bus. And the most recent incident that brought this to a front was the U.S. Turning Manbij, which was fought, recovered from ISIS by the U.S.-backed Kurdish SDF. It has now been turned over to Turkey and their proxy Islamist forces with a deal struck with the United States. And the Kurds were forced to withdraw for a city that they paid a price in blood for. They were previously forced to withdraw from Afrin, and Turkey seized Afrin, the big western canton of the Kurds in the northwest of Syria. So they have realized that the U.S. will always sacrifice them to maintain Turkey and Turkey and NATO and so on. But even those relations are crumbling as the U.S. Yeah. has now put sanctions on Turkish ministers for what they say is the keeping prisoner a U.S. pastor, which has some relations in Turkey. And that is the threat that the U.S. will put sanctions on Turkey if they purchase the Russian S-400 air defense system, which they have signed some types of deals and it's supposed to be completed. The U.S. has threatened Turkey with sanctions if they complete that deal, and Turkey has not responded to that as well. So despite all attempts, the turning over of this territory, the sacrificing of the Kurds, and which has resulted in the Kurds seeking their own settlement with the Syrian government, U.S.-Turkish relations are still in a tail dive.
Yeah, I'm still waiting to see whether it's the U.S. or Turkey that invokes Article 5 of the NATO treaty, because it looks like they might come to blows here and there. It's getting pretty loud, the shouting over there in any event.
Well, there is still another complication with the Turks, and that's the last major, we could call it two separate areas outside of Syrian government control. One of them is Idlib province, which has fell in 2012, and it is basically, and the Western media, when pressed, will admit that it is, for all intents and purposes, controlled by HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is al-Qaeda. Even the U.S. government recognizes that HTS is al-Qaeda. And there are a few other rebel groups in the area, but most of them owe fealty to al-Qaeda, have sworn to them in one form or another. And this is where Idlib has been the dumping ground for jihadis throughout this entire conflict since Russia entered it and the tide started to turn. Every time an area is defeated and the jihadists surrender, if they don't take amnesty deals, then they have always taken the magic green buses to Idlib. And so we have started to see, a forceful exodus of the jihadis from all over the rest of the country to Idlib, which is on the Turkish, Turkish border, hilly mountainous area. Idlib has about 2 million people, and among that are about 120,000 fighters of HTS and other groups. About 15,000 to 20,000 of those are foreigners, foreign jihadis, it is estimated, which includes Chechens, Uyghurs, Saudis, Egyptians, of course, European and U.S. jihadis as well, whole grab bag. But just the news out today. Well, before the news today. So as soon as the South has retaken, there has started to be a repositioning of forces north to Idlib. Right. That if the Kurds cut a deal with the U.S. with the Syrian government and, the U.S. withdraws from the east in one form or another, then it's all about Idlib. And regaining control of this jihadi al-Qaeda occupied territory. And this is serious because this is still a large chunk of a sovereign state occupied by Al-Qaeda at this point. Right. Now, the only reason that they are able to exist where they are, of course, is because they are supported by Turkey. There are convoys of fuel, supplies, food, arms, everything that needs to for the people in their area to survive and to continue the supply of the militants themselves. It simply, as from the beginning of the conflict, it can't exist without Turkish supply lines. And of course, there's likely other Gulf countries that are still funding this, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and others. It seems that Qatar may have stopped. But it all has to go through Turkish hands and Turkish territory. And on the border there every day, there are convoys that go back and forth.
Right.
Turkey, as part of the Astana agreements with Russia and Iran, Turkey was supposed to be responsible for Idlib as a de-escalation zone. And they have actually established supposedly 12 watch posts throughout Idlib. It's a big area. 12 watch posts isn't very much, with some troops that were actually set up basically in agreement with Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda accompanying them and agreeing where they could set up these outposts. Turkey was supposed to restore some degree of law and order, supposed to separate the, quote, moderate rebels from Al-Qaeda, which has been the problem with every agreement, whether it was Obama or every agreement that has ever tried to been made to settle this peacefully with even the Geneva process. This has always been the problem. It has been impossible to separate the, quote, moderate rebels from Al-Qaeda and the other jihadis because they are, of course, the same thing. Turkey has been unable to fulfill this. Attacks continue to be held out of Idlib, into Latakia and other areas, eastern Aleppo province controlled by the government and elsewhere, because they are Al-Qaeda and jihadis. And although they have been busy killing each other and fighting for local control hierarchies, HDS asserting its authority over other jihadi and rebel groups, leaders, being assassinating each other. They've done a good job of working on each other for quite a while, which has neutralized some of their offensive capability. But Turkey hasn't fulfilled what they promised because, of course, they want to see Idlib become part of their protectorate that they have carved out of northern Syria. Immediately to the east, to the north and east of this area, is the Jarablus area north of Aleppo, the so-called Euphrates Shield operation, whereby Turkey invaded northern Syria with its military forces under guise of the Astana, an abuse of the Astana agreement, seized control of the area, has turned it over to what they call the New Syrian Army, which is basically Ahrar al-Sham, the Al-Qaeda splinter group, radical Wahhabist jihadis, and other remnants of the Free Syrian Army and other Islamist groups that the Turkey has put into uniforms calls the New Syrian Army. And they have elected local governments, governance in the form of Sharia councils over this area. They've made a show of trying to show that they're devolving things to their proxies. But they're also flying Turkish flags, setting up Turkish national post offices, and teaching Turkish in the schools and in the Islamist schools to the people in the area. The Turkish government claims they are driving out the Kurdish terrorists, and they are turning over the area to the true owners, which are obviously Ahrar al-Sham and friends. They hope to resettle a lot of Turkmen and Islamist refugees from the rest of Syria that are in Turkey into this area. And of course, they hope to do the same to Idlib as well. Turkey is very alarmed at the idea that the Syrian army has so quickly polished up the south and is now moving on at Idlib. And they say that if, despite their not fulfilling their promises with the Astana agreement and restoring law and order to Idlib, if the Syrian government does it by force, then they will withdraw from the Astana agreement. And it's presumed resume supply of the Idlib jihadis, not just for the sake of survival, but, you know, providing them the equipment to start serious offensives again against Syrian government territory. So this is now a very complicated dance that Russia has to play, because the U.S. and Turkish relation is on the rocks, but at the same time, the Russian-Turkish relation faces the final resolution in Syria that it was always fated to come down to. Russia hoped to cut everyone, the Saudis, the Qataris, the UAE, the US, where they were supporting the Islamist rebels, out of this whole process and simply deal with Turkey. And when you're dealing with Turkey, you were essentially dealing with the rebels, the Islamists and jihadis that were their proxies. So it's not exactly a partnership, as the Russian government continues refers to it, but it was more a complicated geopolitical dance with Putin and Erdogan waltzing across the Syrian dance floor with daggers poised at each other's backs.
Yeah, right.
While they smile and gaze into each other's eyes.
Yeah.
This is what's been going on. But now it's finally coming to the inevitable head, and Turkey is faced with a choice. And it is not a good choice, because they are not in a good situation. Their relationship with the U.S. is on the rocks as well. They have domestic problems at home, and they are will they back off of Idlib? And if Idlib is then brought back under government control, something that may take a half a year or more, it could be much less. It could be, 2 months if they don't receive regular supplies from the Turks and if their morale proves low. Then do they withdraw from Syria their own military? That would be the final step right there. So it's this two adjacent areas, Idlib and the Euphrates Shield Zone established by Turkey. And that is where the action in Syria is moving. And this is, a very important geopolitical movement. Erdogan is in a really tight place. His economy is hurting. The the Turkish lira has dropped substantially against the dollar. He's now facing U.S. sanctions. He is in a domestic, pretty strong position, having just won, quote, elections, unquote. But he's got a lot of problems. Russian, Iranian, and the Turkish governments will be meeting in the Astana format. In the last few days, they have been meeting, and they will be meeting again next month in Tehran. And it is hoped that Turkey will come to their senses and some negotiated settlement will be reached. But this is where it was all going to end eventually. The Erdogan regime has a decision to make, fateful decision.
Mm. We got about 3 minutes left, and there's a lot of complexities to still explore. But one thing that's interesting is there's going to be fallout. You had a lot of moving parts and a lot of players. You had the Saudis, and you had, you still have these. The Saudis, the Israelis also, the training grounds in Jordan, and, of course, the U.S., Russia and Turkey and these others, and by the way, Qatar.
Iran, Hezbollah.
Iraq, else, yeah. That's right. Yeah. So, but I'm interested in, you know, we've got this thing about Tillerson that came out. I know we can't really probe it until next week, but, you know, there was essentially, we know, a break between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Almost came to blows, apparently. And, you know, they were all involved in this mess, too. And I'm wondering what the, you know, as the whole thing breaks down on the ground in Syria, what kind of stuff is being taken home from Syria to these places that's going to stoke, you know, some antagonisms in the relationship between these countries?
Yeah, so the big story in the last week out on this, it was broken in The Intercept. As I can tell, it's been picked up the American Conservative and a few other places. Alex Emmons and The Intercept. Saudi Arabia planned to invade Qatar last summer. Rex Tillerson's effort to stop it may have cost him his job. So this says that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates were actually intent on invading Qatar last summer and essentially conquering it and replacing its government with one that wouldn't even talk to Iran. Tillerson evidently led a quiet onslaught of diplomacy and threats from Foggy Bottom to stop this from happening. In so doing, he earned the ire of Mohammed bin Salman and the UAE, who then conducted a private campaign against him, showing how much meddling and influence that Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states have in Washington, and that this may have been the real reason that Trump then got rid of Tillerson, was this pressure from Saudi Arabia.
In other words, regime change at the Department of State that was
Saudi Arabia. Stopped regime change in Qatar, and Saudi returned the favor with regime changing Tillerson out of the Secretary of State.
Which is pretty amazing. You know, if you think about Saudi Arabia being nothing more really than an oil field with a lot of weapons and big bank accounts, and Tillerson, you know, the penultimate oil company executive for most of his career, you know, the CEO of ExxonMobil. That's a pretty interesting battle.
I'm going to make a confession. Despite him previously having been a CEO of ExxonMobil, I actually liked Tillerson's performance, his quiet performance, his refusal to use human rights as a hypocritical bludgeon against other countries.
It always seemed like he was the grown-up in the room when he was meeting with them, he was a real player in the international scene in business. We're out of time, so we're going to have to come back to this next week. Yeah. Mark, thank you very much for your time, as always.
Thanks for having me, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. On this edition of Crosstalk, we discuss whether détente is possible, even desirable. Why isn't it a good idea to get along with Russia? And much, much more. Crosstalking détente, I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Eric Krauss. He's an independent political risk analyst. Also, we have Dmitry Babich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And in Cyprus, we have Alex Christoforo. He's the director and writer for TheDuran.com. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to Alex first in Cyprus. We have a new phrase that's popped up in the latest news cycle, and that's criminalizing diplomacy. And an esteemed expert, probably the greatest living expert on Russia in the Western world, Stephen Cohen, was on CNN with, someone with a very dubious road record when it comes to foreign policy, Mr. Max Boot. Before I go to you, Alex, let's have a watch at this clip.
I've been studying Russia for 45 years. I've lived in Russia and I've lived here.
And you've been consistently an apologist for Russia in those 45 years.
Russia hasn't... Excuse me, what did you say to me?
I said you've been consistently an apologist for Russia in those last 45 years.
All right, I don't do defamation of people. I do serious analysis of serious national security problems. When people like you call people like me, and not only me, but people more eminent than me, apologists for Russia, because we don't agree with your analysis, you are criminalizing diplomacy.
Okay, Alex, criminalizing diplomacy. I think it really hits the nail on the head here, because any kind of rational thought about what kind of foreign policy or bilateral relationship Russia and the United States should have is called into question by people like Max Boot, that gets a lot of airtime for reasons that is a mystery to me. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I find it strange that Max Boot is calling Stephen Cohen a Putin apologist. I like to call Max Boot a war machine apologist. He's an apologist for the military-industrial complex. He's an apologist for war criminals. Has this guy gotten anything right ever in his career? He pushed Iraq WMDs. He was wrong. He pushed Libya. He was wrong. He pushed Syria. He was wrong. He pushed Ukraine. He was wrong. It's absolutely amazing that they give this guy any airtime whatsoever. And we can remember, I think it was 3 or 4 months back, Peter, remember that Tucker Carlson had Max Boot
his
show. And Tucker Carlson
crushed
demolished
him.
Max Boot. He crushed him. And he showed what an idiot Max Boot. Max Boot is an apologist for stupid people around the world.
Dima, but he's very popular, okay, because he says the right things to the right people.
Well, on that video, Stephen Cohen also has to explain to Max Boot that this so-called Russia meddling, it's not Pearl Harbor. Well, I think, you know, I was very impressed when several U.S. senators and other prominent politicians, when they compared 2016 election and the alleged Russian meddling to Pearl Harbor, one of the people just wrote, "Hey, you idiots, you know, my father survived Pearl Harbor. He saw what it was. Please, you know, stop doing that." You know, these kind of comparisons are insulting to America in the first place.
Not only is that, Eric, I mean, we have a new call for sanctions coming out of the U.S. Senate. Now, they're on vacation right now. They're on leave, so I don't think they're going to act upon it. But it's really just virtue signaling, okay? And I think we're going to continue to see this until the midterms.
It's one-upsmanship. Basically, there is a large part of the American political establishment which is desperate to find something to beat Trump with. And that is the Russia card. And nobody loses points for beating up on Russia. Now, that's the fact that this goes against American fundamental diplomatic and geopolitical interests, which are really to avoid creating a coalition between Russia and China, isn't their problem. Their problem right now is to score quick political gain.
Yes, Alex, let me go back to you in Cyprus. Quick political gain. And of course, they're getting it. But the implications in the long term are fundamental, because I think now that it's a generational thing. I mean, why in the world would Russia want to have better relations with the United States? It doesn't have much trade. OK, the issues that bring them together, Russia holds most of the cards here. And you have a political establishment in the United States that is at war with itself. So, I mean, detente is possible, but the Americans and the foreign policy blob assume that Russia wants that. I don't think that's the case. Go ahead, Alex.
And how can you have detente when just the other day you had this bizarre White House press briefing where all the guys were there? You had Christopher Wray, you had Coates, you had Bolton. And once again, they're pushing out the narrative of Russia election involvement.
Exactly.
Keep in mind, they're not saying meddling anymore. They're not saying interference. Now it's involvement. And of course, no one's defining what the hell this is. They're just sitting there and they're getting together. This is Trump's deep state. These are the guys that are in the Trump administration who are the deep state, and they're pushing this narrative, and they're scapegoating Russia, because if the Democrats lose, it's going to be Russia's fault.
Exactly.
If the Republicans lose, it's going to be Russia's fault. So Russia is the ultimate scapegoat.
You know, Dima, it's the paranoia of not knowing what you don't know. There's going to be some meddling, but how and where? The assumption that it's going to be.
Let me remind you that the election has not yet happened. It's
going
to be in November 2018, but Dan Coats is already saying, the head of the National Intelligence, he's already saying that there is evidence about Russia's involvement. And we have Lindsey Graham, who has just advised President Trump to check the so-called ball that Putin gave to him in Helsinki, to check it for KGB bugs. We have this very sane person elaborating with other senators this new draft law, which is called, if I am not mistaken in the translation, Protecting American Security from the Kremlin's Aggression 2018. So these guys, they can foresee the future. They can see how Russia is meddling into an election.
You know what this
that
reminds me
happened?
Of, Eric? You know what this reminds me? It's kind of a bad episode of The Twilight Zone, okay?
Listen, we've got to, unfortunately, have to take it seriously. You are talking about, well, what does Russia want from the United States? Russia wants to be left alone.
Russia has its own problems.
Russia is still undergoing a major restructuring. And the Americans have managed to weaponize finance. They can cause a lot of damage by blocking people from the international financial system. They block them from the dollar system first, but then the European banks are all running scared of the U.S. Treasury. So they can do substantial damage. And yes, the political dialogue in Washington has become absurd.
That means that there's the assumption that somehow, under some circumstances, Russia is going to buckle.
Russia is not going to buckle. Russia is most certainly not going to buckle. And Russia has survived very well everything they've thrown at it for the simple reason that Russia has had a very conservative fiscal and monetary policy. The central bank has done an excellent job of insulating Russia from the shocks, but it's still very inconvenient.
Sure. Yeah. Dima, jump in.
This draft law has not yet been published, but Lindsey Graham has already...
That's why I think when they proposed that they went on recess, they have really no intention right now of doing it. It's just part of the course, the background. Go ahead, Dima.
But the things that we know about it are already very, very sinister, not only for Russians. Anyone who is suspected of influencing the American elections can be barred from entering the country. Maybe even American citizens.
That's a really good, Alex. Dima got to the punchline before me. Does that mean the FBI and the CIA and all the rest of them?
The
Israelis always have an influence in American politics. But the interesting thing is that they're not addressing the real meddling in the 2016 election, and that is in the DOJ and the FBI. Alex.
And the corporate media, don't forget.
Yeah, the DOJ, the FBI, and let's not forget the real election meddling was also against Bernie Sanders.
Right.
And it was Hillary Clinton and the DNC that ripped off Bernie Sanders from winning the Democratic nomination. And the bill that they're proposing right now is very sinister indeed. They're even asking Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, to examine placing Russia on the state list of terrorist sponsors. That's how hysterical this thing is becoming.
Yeah, there's a lot of grandstanding here.
Putting Russia on a list for state sponsors of terror, that's a little bit more than grandstanding, okay? And Eric, you know, let me go to Dima here. It's hard to walk these things back. My question to Eric earlier is, this isn't working under the assumption that Russia is going to surrender. That is a wrong assumption.
Well, it works on a lot of assumptions. For example, it suggests to penalize Russia for the production and use of chemical weapons. You know, who used chemical weapons? Okay, there is the Duma thing, you know, where people who were shown on the video by the white helmets to be victims of a chemical attack, later on these people, healthy and alive, addressed a press conference in The Hague and told how this fake video was made.
That actually,
but they continue
what
to
you
work
just
on it.
Said happened, mm-hmm. but it's not only RT and a few other outlets reported the backstory to this false flag operation.
Well, all the others concentrated on who paid the air ticket for these people to come from Damascus to The Hague. Well, okay, these people are on the video that you showed to the whole world. You said they were victims of a chemical attack. Why don't you want to listen to them,
Let me go back to Cyprus here. One more minute before we go to the break here. So it looks like Russia is just going to be continued all the way to the midterms. Or in lieu of the Mueller report. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I think even when the Mueller report is finalized, and I think we are coming to an end, it's very apparent that the whole Russia thing is just going to last until probably until Trump either wins re-election, and that's going to go on for another 4 years, or until they get rid of Trump, because the Russia thing is not dying down. And you can see it in the White House press briefing. They're going to scapegoat Russia for everything. But the most important point to all of this is that the American people don't care. We've seen poll after poll,
Alex,
which shows that Russia ranks very low.
Just real quick, do you think Paul Manafort will go to federal prison because he has good taste in clothes?
He definitely has the good taste in clothes, and I think when everything wraps up, he will get a pardon from Trump.
I think that's in the cards here. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go to Eric now. We were talking about this new Senate bill that's going to sanction the Russian economy and individuals. But this is a pattern, and you alluded to it earlier. This is warfare by different means. It's, yeah. It's sanctioned warfare. Yeah. Yeah. And we see the U.S. applying it, and particularly what's nuanced here under the Trump administration, that it's used against, quote-unquote, allies. We could talk a little bit about Turkey on that, too.
The problem basically is that the global financial system since basically 1945 has been very heavily dollarized. And this was it wasn't really a topic for discussion for a long time. Now, more recently, the Americans have decided that it's easier to throw sanctions than to shoot weapons, than to shoot missiles. So basically what they can do, and what they've done in the case of Russia, is cut off individuals from the control of their own assets. Some of these oligarchs were very close to the Kremlin. Others were very distant from the Kremlin. Major Russian companies have suddenly become unable to do business on the global market. They can do this, and they can, it's sort of like using snipers. They can take out people on the streets of Moscow from a distance. And it's relatively hard to fight against because you could say, but people will use the euro. But the European banks
will buckle too.
Of the secondary sanctions. So it's really quite hard to fight against. And if you take countries like Turkey, they're doing the same thing. They're not happy with Turkish policy, so they're sanctioning individuals.
Yeah, but Dima, this is all very unilateral here, isn't it?
Just a small footnote. Not only people on the streets of Moscow, but also their relatives.
Yes.
Because the law says, the draft law says that not only the Russian businessmen who have any relations with the Russian government will be tracked, but also their relatives. This is really sinister. Coming back to the Turkish thing, it's the first precedent when one NATO country is applying sanctions against another NATO member country. And it is doing that, the United States is doing that, in the framework of the so-called Magnitsky List. Now, these two Turkish ministers, Süleyman Soylu of the Interior and Abdulhamid Gül of the Justice, they are basically sanctioned, they are attacked in the framework of the Magnitsky List. Why? Because of that person from the United States who basically has been living in Turkey for, 23 years, who hasn't been doing anything in the United States. Well, if you tell me about it's about freedom of religion, I'm sorry, I don't believe you.
Alex, let me go to you. I absolutely agree with Dima. It has nothing to do about freedom of conscience and religion here. It's really about changing the behavior of Erdogan's regime. This is a lot about Iran. It's a lot about Syria
and Russia.
And the interesting thing is that the European Union, they will buckle and they will take a knee. The Turks are not going to take a knee, and we're going to find this out fast and hard in November because they're not going to respect the sanctions imposed upon them by the United States vis-a-vis Iran. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I think that the United States and the EU are going to be very surprised to see a very strong Erdogan, a very determined Erdogan to not buckle. And what we saw in Turkey last week, and we discussed this, Peter, what we saw in Turkey was a Turkey that is exploring its options. We saw them going to the BRICS meeting. We saw China and Russia and all the BRICS members very happy to have Turkey on board. And we're seeing Turkey now even examining and considering its NATO membership. And this is huge. This is a geopolitical earthquake to see Turkey.
It's like Brexit. It's like Brexit. It's a Brexit here. Dima, is Erdogan flirting right now? Is he in the bazaar right now? Because I don't see them leaving NATO anytime soon, but it's planting the seed. We have options. We have friends.
Turkey has already been excluded from the United States weapons program. I mean, it's serious.
You know,
the rhetoric between Turkey and the EU was awful in the last few months. So basically, all of this adventure in the Middle East that Mr. Obama started, you know, when he basically supported the insurgents against the Syrian government, it backfired terribly. Because what did the United States want to do? You know, from the point of view of interests of the United States, they wanted to take out one small regime, which was basically not anti-American, but which had a pro-Soviet history, the Syrian regime. What was the net result? They lost a much more important ally. Turkey
in the process.
And they failed to oust the Syrian regime. But I just want to return very quickly to this very important detail about the Magnitsky Act. Let us remind our listeners and our viewers what it came from, you know. In 2012, the United States supported a rogue businessman, Bill Browder. You know, his lawyer died in the Russian prison. And Browder turned it against Russia,
There is an excellent documentary on the internet, on YouTube. But you have to look for it, because Browder and his people are having it taken down left and
just
right.
Just a few words. You know, Browder came to Russia in the 1990s with $46 million of not his money. He left Russia in 2005 with $2 billion, you know.
Did he pay taxes on that?
Well, Paul Manafort is now being investigated for not paying taxes on the amounts which are one-thousandths of the amount that Bill Browder paid. But Bill Browder shed his U.S. citizenship on time. So now we have Paul Manafort facing a possible sentence of 305 years.
I think he shed a lot more than that. Yeah. Okay.
Browder is presented as a human rights activist.
I'm not a lawyer, so I'm going to be careful here. Yeah. You know, let's stick with the Turkish theme here, because I think, you know, I brought up with Alex here, this is like a looming Brexit. I mean, Erdogan is a very difficult person to work
with.
He's
a loose cannon.
But he's certainly sending very strong signals that he's not happy with the status quo.
Turkey's
never going to be part of the European Union. He's beginning to see his options.
He almost got into a shooting war with Russia, we shouldn't forget, about 18 months ago. They've patched this one over very nicely. Mr. Putin forgave and forgot. But the problem is, if you look at Russian policy, Russian economic policy, Russia has been able to defy the empire because they've had a very careful and a very conservative domestic policy. Turkey has not. The lira is falling like a rock. Turkish businesses are very heavily indebted. They have to refinance huge amounts.
But there are options, aren't there?
That would be a good reason to
join BRICS, wouldn't it? Options. You would have access to international finance.
China does not provide the kind of finance that Turkey needs right now. China provides state-to-state finance. They do not provide much private finance. Remember, the RMB is still not convertible. The Hong Kong banks are scared to death of the Americans. They will not provide any support to any sanctioned entity. Chinese banks, they can't, because they don't have a convertible currency.
Not yet. But they have a whole lot of dollars, Dima. Go ahead. I don't think they want the Chinese currency.
The problem is that China is not very happy with the United States neither. Not only Turkey is not happy with the United States.
It's a slow process.
Yes.
It's
the White House has just imposed import tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports to the United States. China responded by a much smaller strike. And tell me now, who is hampering free trade here? Let me quote Xi Jinping, at the Davos Forum just 1 year ago. He said this, We must promote trade and investment, liberalization and facilitation through opening up, and say no to protectionism. End of quote. This is exactly the rhetoric that the United States has been using against other countries for 50 years at least, right?
Yes,
now China is using it with a reason.
We are waiting for the development of an alternative global financial system, and because we want it, we see it right around the corner. The problem is this is a decade-long process.
Probably longer.
A lot of time. And I mean, global commodities are priced in dollars. Most global capital flows are in dollars. So China can begin to replace this, but they're going to do it in their own time.
Let me go to Alex here. I mean, we've already gotten a lot of examples here how the sanction warfare works. But, you know, when the hegemon with the almighty dollar, you start antagonizing too many people at the same time.
Yes.
Then, you know, politics is always about odd bedfellows, okay? You're going to have these odd bedfellows beginning to work together, and this is going to be at the exclusion of the United States. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, and especially when you antagonize leaders like Erdogan. And when we can't forget that after the coup, the failed coup, Erdogan made sure that he purged the military of all its power, and he solidified his power. And much like Trump in the U.S., Erdogan has a base in the middle of Turkey, inside Turkey, that's very, very loyal to him.
Yep.
And no matter how bad the situation can get in Turkey, Erdogan can always turn to his base, and he can make sure that he's going to stay in power. And that's the problem, that the U.S. is antagonizing leaders that are very powerful and that have a very strong base that will support them through thick and through thin.
Well, I think it's very important that the Magnitsky Act was used against Turkey, because what is it about the Magnitsky Act? It is against Western values. People are included in that blacklist without them even knowing
it
sometimes,
yeah.
Without a trial. It's just enough that the New York Times or the Washington Post write something bad about this person, right? And until now, these were Russians targeted by this list. Now these are Turks. Tomorrow, maybe Chinese.
Yeah,
so you have a coalition against this kind of policy from the United States, which is basically defending Western values.
The point, I think, that we can all agree is that the United States is going to eventually create a coalition of countries which are simply too uncomfortable with a system which has been shown to be very, very dangerous to them. And at some point, they are going to begin to coalesce around China, which is the elephant in the elevator. Now, this is something that Trump understood. And Trump was very much desirous of pulling Russia away from China.
We've discussed this so many times here. I think the first test here, gentlemen, we're almost out of time here. The first test is going to be in November. What countries are going to obey Washington when it comes to Iran's oil exports? We already know that Turkey is not going to honor it.
India is not going to do it.
China certainly is not. So this is going to be a very interesting litmus test. At the same time, we have a hot and cold rhetoric coming out of the White House when it comes to Iran. So that will be a developing story. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. That's all the time we have for this part of our program. Many thanks to our guests in Moscow and in Cyprus. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.